Welcome to the Georgia Tech Catholic Center podcast. Today, I'm with Father Branson. This is Jude McIntyre, and I'm going to be asking some questions to Father Branson about Lent. I'd like to begin the podcast talking about the number 40. The number 40 appears 159 times in the Bible, usually in the Old Testament, and it's associated with trial and sacrifice. We all know the stories about the 40-day flood, the Israelites traveling 40 years in the wilderness, the spies taking 40 days to find Cana, and the 40 lashes. It also shows up in the New Testament with Jesus' 40-day fast in the desert and the 40 days between his resurrection and his ascension. The first time the Lenten fast is mentioned by official church documents is in the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. Although this is the first time it's mentioned, the Lenten fast was actually a practice for the early Christians before then. St. Bishop Irenaeus wrote a letter to St. Pope Victor saying, "Variation in observance did not originate in our own day, but very much earlier in the times of our forefathers." This shows that Christians were celebrating Lent, or at least practicing a Lenten fast, even before the Council of Nicaea. The Lenten fast originally specifically applied to new converts before baptism on Easter. It was a period for them to purify themselves before entering the church.
Yeah, and even today, that this specific period of Lent for catechumens, those preparing for baptism, is called the period of purification and enlightenment, recognizing there is a time of detachment, right? Even if you think about practically, like if someone has like a breakup and like a bad relationship, there's usually a time when they need to like kind of heal and like grieve and kind of get past anything, right? So anytime we're detaching from the bad, or even just moving into a new phase of life, there needs to be a season of adjustment, and that can feel like the desert. So like at the level of the like human experience, times of transition or times of change, and especially like times of conversion, there is this like experience of the desert.
Yeah, a transition period, a purging period is very thematically Catholic. So about the origin of Lent, what do you think the origin of Lent reflects about the church, how it prescribes practices or describes practices?
Well, I think that one, again, at the human level, like if you're going to do a marathon, you need to train, right? Or even if someone's getting married, there is a time of preparation, not even just like we need to buy the flowers and figure all that out, but like I actually need to prepare to say yes to this person. But the first Sunday of Lent is always, the reading is always the temptation of Jesus in the desert. And the preface for that talks about our Lent being patterned after Jesus's 40 days in the desert. What was he doing in the desert? Why did he even go to the desert? Well, the first thing is, this is immediately after his baptism where the Father says, "You are my beloved Son, with you I am well pleased." And so out of who he is as the Son, he goes out into the desert in order to be with us and our temptation. We say that he is like us in all things but sin. So there's actually something very, very beautiful of if the first problem was man's disobedience, the first thing that Jesus does is go into the desert to be tempted in order to be obedient to the Father, but also to actually show us the way forward and even how he responds to the temptations. And so he is like not asking anything of us that he himself isn't living. And so, which is also connected to, yeah, this time in the desert of the Israelites, 40 years in the desert. I even think of practically somebody that's detoxing from like serious addiction to like alcohol or whatever. There is a time of pure detox, which is super painful at the like neurological level, right? And then there is the time of learning new habits and a new way of being. If you're addicted to drink and all of your friends were connected to the bar and you can't go back to the bar, right? Like you need a whole new way of life. Like all of your life was bent around the thing that you worshiped and became attached to, right? Mm-hmm. So now you need to learn a whole new life, and that's not automatic at all. So any change always involves some period of like time of transition, and it can seem like the desert, mm-hmm. right? So there's something deeply human about this, but Lent itself is patterned after Christ's 40 days in the desert.
Something that I've always wondered about is, why does Jesus need to be cared for by the angels? Why is he tired? Why does the temptation affect him?
Because he's fully human and fully divine, right? So in his humanity is this. This is the thing, is that like he actually was genuinely tempted, but he never detaches himself from the Father, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you think about it, even people today's accusation, like when we're suffering, the accusation thrown at God is kind of, you don't understand, right? Like you actually don't understand what it's like. And we've always been able to, in some way, in like really childish ways, but I think there is a really honest question in there of like, you actually don't understand. And so out of love for us and to bring us back in his humanity, he genuinely experiences these things. And it says he was hungry. Mm-hmm. It says he was tired. So there's a very like specific Christological questions of how this is possible with his like fullness of humanity and fullness of divinity. But I think what's important for us is this thing of when we're undergoing real temptation, or it seems like we're in the desert, or it seems like we're alone, when we look over at the face of Christ, we see, like, I have this very distinct memory of a particularly difficult period of my life, and I was driving my car, and there had just been a lot of difficult things going on, and I was just like, God, like, this is all so difficult, and, like, this is, like, a huge mess. And I had, like, was almost kind of picturing the crucified face of Christ being like, you're telling me, like he understands suffering. And it was very consoling for me of, oh yeah, like you actually understand suffering and you understand mess and you are with me in it. And our great, like the worst thing, even like if we fail a test and like we're not the only one, it's such a relief, you know? Like, but if you're the only one that fails the test, there's such an isolation in that. I have this other memory of we had this like really difficult quiz in Christology, and which is about like the nature of Christ. And I remember being like blown away by how difficult it was. And I was like, oh shoot, like not only am I going to fail this class, but I don't know Jesus. But then I remember looking across the room at my best friend in this look of panic on his face. And I was like, oh, thank you. Like, it's not just me. Like, we're all in the same boat, right? So there is a specific thing of when we feel really alone in a suffering, there's such a despair there. But if we're in it together, it's a whole different game, mm-hmm. right? Even, like, I think about the greatness of, like, the TV show Band of Brothers, right? Like there is such a closeness in experiencing suffering together, right? Of even, like, there is a, like, brotherhood in suffering that like nothing else can touch, to the point where soldiers go back to the battlefields where they fought because no one else can understand but those other soldiers, mm-hmm. you know? So there's something about in our suffering, but also in our like the difficulty of conversion, it's so difficult to change. It's so difficult to be open. It's so difficult to let go of attachment to sin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? But the face that we look over at is the hungry, tired, struggling Christ. Right, who allows himself to be tempted and who allows himself to be ministered to by the angels, because everything like for him hinges upon what the Father is asking of him. And then it makes things easier for us of all I have to do is what the Father is asking of me. And sometimes that means going into the desert. Sometimes that means being taken care of, right? Mm-hmm. It makes things so much simpler. And not in a way that's an avoidance of reality, but actually like so much deeper. And so one of the things that we'll talk about of this text I want to propose that we read during Lent is he says, like, Jesus doesn't overcome Satan through a moral superiority. It's not that he's morally stronger, right? Just like you're physically stronger than mm-hmm. me, so you can lift more stuff than me. Like, that's not how it is morally with Jesus. He's more of a son. He lives everything attached to the Father. And so is even leading us to how to overcome temptation. So if you look at the actual temptations in the desert, he speaks of the Father and he quotes scripture. And even when Satan tries to dazzle and distract him, there's so many things that are super flashy in the temptations, immediately takes him up to the top of the temple, right? Shows him all the kingdom and says, everything can be yours. It's super flashy and distracting, just like super flashy, like videos every 9 seconds, right? That like distract you. And then you're like, oh my gosh, it's been 2 hours, right? There's a flashiness that distracts us from reality. And Christ in front of this speaks of the Father. Like he never forgets the Father. And for me, that's super consoling of like, yeah, like the problem of life is to be attached to God the Father. and he will take care of the rest. Does that make sense?
Yeah, especially if we're living our lives in periods of struggle and distraction, it's consoling to remember that God is always there. No matter how distracted you get or how much anxiety you have, he'll still be there, like loving you equally, no matter what.
And not only that, but like, it's not a like, yeah, I understand from a distance, but his like, take my yoke upon me, for my yoke is easy, my burden light. I'm sure you already know this, but the specific Greek word for the yoke is actually a double yoke, meaning two like horses or oxen side by side. So it's not, I'm putting this yoke on you and you carry me somewhere. It's, we're actually going to be yoked side by side. So be shoulder to shoulder with me. Right. And so in everything he's asking, it's not just from a distance, but like when he's calling you to this difficult thing, he's saying, like, be with me in it. Right.
This is kind of a side thing, but when Jesus is entering in on the donkeys, Matthew writes that he's straddling on two donkeys, because back then, in order for something to be true, you would need two witnesses for it. And so Matthew likes to double everything. He likes to double the amount of blind people, double the amount of donkeys. So I always think it's funny, Jesus riding on two donkeys at the same time. But what are some of the main tenets of Lent that we're following?
So the first thing is, I would say more than anything else, following the liturgical season, right? So entering into what the church actually proposes through like the liturgical season, leading up to the holiest, most important like time, which is Easter, and then the Easter season, right? So everything is leading up to that, but it has its own rhythm and things going on. So I would say first and foremost, following the liturgical season, right? Along with that, though, there's certain things that are prescribed. For instance, fasting and abstinence on Ash Wednesday and on Good Friday. And then also like not eating meat on Fridays, right? And then along with that, these like three beautiful practices that we call prayer, fasting, and almsgiving, right? Those are the specific things that are prescribed during Lent.
What do we mean about time frames regarding like what is happening during Good Friday or happening during Easter? Are we symbolically remembering the death of Jesus and remembering the resurrection of Jesus? What do we mean that on Good Friday, Jesus leaves us for a period of time?
Yeah, so it's twofold. One, there's this great line from Samuel Johnson. He says, man doesn't need to be taught so much as reminded. If you think about it, even sometimes our big spiritual insights are like very simple things that like, God loves us, or I need to depend on him. You know, very simple things, but it's actually, we need to be like reminded of stuff. The liturgical year is this like being reminded of being immersed in the history. But even with the Mass, right, there's a specific word, anamnesis. And anamnesis is to recall an event so profoundly you're actually brought back to it. And so this is why at Passover, right, they say, and this is why we were saved from slavery in Egypt. Not our ancestors, but we. So it's recalling an event to the point where you're almost brought back to it. We say there's only one Mass, right? Only one Mass offered by Jesus. But in some way, in the mystery of the sacrament, there is this anamnesis where we are brought back into the like eternal Mass, right? So this is one of the things that like non-Catholic Christians will say, that we're almost like re-sacrificing Christ. And it's like, no, we're entering into the Paschal mystery that's there. So there's an aspect of remembering, but there's also an aspect of entering into, right? Anamnesis. Like being brought back to the event.
So it's something that transcends time.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. On abstinence, why are we giving things up on fasting? Why do we have to fast? If God gave us these great things like meat or Chick-fil-A and chocolate, why do we have to give those things up?
The big three. Yes. Meat, Chick-fil-A, and chocolate. Yes.
I don't understand why the church hates chocolate so much.
First of all, by our very nature, we are limited, right? If I'm looking at you, it means I can't look at that painting over there, right? So our limitation always implies a choice, right? And not only that, but because we're bound by space and time, if I am saying yes to one thing, it means I'm saying no to everything else, right? Which forces a question of what is worth my life? What is worth my time? And there are certain things that are objectively good, but they aren't the most important thing. And we can get the order wrong on things and become attached to things that are less important, right? Mm-hmm. Eating lunch is good, but if one of y'all collapses and needs to go to the hospital, I can't be like, I'm gonna eat my lunch, right? Mm-hmm. It's no, I need to go with you, right? To anoint you and to be with you. So there's something in that moment that takes a higher priority, right? Every yes actually implies a no to other things. This is at the, like, this is for all human beings, right? So it's not a, these things are bad. And often, like, in the world that we live in, it almost gets interpreted in that way, in like a dualistic or Gnostic way, where it's like body bad, spirit good. But it's actually a, like, I want to say yes to what's most important and what's most beautiful. And that actually implies a no to other things, right? So it's like, and part of it too is like to not have like improper attachments to things, because the world is like good and draws out desire, but we can also tend towards idolatry, meaning we give part of ourselves to things, right? So like, and this is what sin is, right? So like over attachment to eating, drinking, right? To noise, etc. Music is a good thing. But if I have to have music on all the time to the point where I'm avoiding silence, I'm actually saying yes to music to the point where there's actually no space for God, right? Mm-hmm. So it's about actually making a space for one who is worth saying yes to. Just like if my best friend was coming up here to visit, I may have things planned, but I would set some things aside in order to be with him. And I would also need to set some things aside in the sense of like, cleaning up upstairs, changing the sheets for the bed, etc., right? In like the guest room, like you would make space to, so it's not to say no to things, but to say yes to what's most important. And that implies a no to other things.
It reminds me of the Catholic definition of freedom, which is really beautiful to me, where denying yourself things that you want and taking up your own difficulties, taking up your cross, actually frees you. And freedom itself is not defined by being able to do what you want, but it's defined by aligning your will with God's will, which is it's really interesting way of defining freedom, especially because in our American Enlightenment way of defining freedom, it's very different. We mainly perceive freedom as the freedom to do what we want, but that's not really what freedom is.
You know, the thing I'm fascinated by with this is that, like, there are sectors that understand this, but it's very non-integrated. So I think two of the biggest examples is people who exercise understand this, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you are limiting yourself to, like, in lifting and everything. Like, it's a grind, right? And there's a proper form. And if you do it wrong, you get injured, right? Mm-hmm. But if you follow it, and it feels like unfreedom, right? But over time, it introduces a greater freedom where you're able to run faster, jump higher, right? Mm-hmm. Same with music. It feels, so you just want to play your song that you love, but it is so frustrating to like get your fingers to try to like be in like the proper position to like play the guitar or whatever. It's so frustrating. But over time, in the like unfreedom of that, of saying yes, like being obedient to the instrument and to one's instructor, you're able to play music, and there is an expression of freedom within that. So I would argue this is the freedom that we're talking about, right? You're saying yes to something, you're being obedient to it in a way that generates a greater freedom in you. Mm-hmm. And so like what's interesting for me about the modern world is that this is really understood in the world of education, of music, and of like exercise, but it's not understood in the moral life, where in saying yes to the right things, it actually makes me more free. And if I don't say yes to them, it actually makes me a slave, right? And so it's totally fragmented from the moral life. And so I'm like looking at gym bros and I'm being like, man, if you lived this in an integrated way, you would understand like morality, right? Mm-hmm. And the relationship with Christ, that it like blossoms into a beautiful freedom. Does that make sense?
Yep. I definitely have experience with gaining freedom through exercise. Like, for example, if a 410-pound beam ever falls on a lady, then I just need to tell her to be calm for, like, a good 40 minutes while I get my warm-up in. I'll get my lifting belt, and then I can eventually squat it up.
The thing that horrifies me about this is the first thing that you're going to do is tell this lady, be calm.
Well, I need my time to warm up. Okay, the next tenet I'd like to talk about is prayer. Why is prayer important? Not just like praying for your meal or praying at Mass. How is it important to pray every day?
Yeah, it's because at the level of relationship, right, like we want to be with the one that we love, right? And like that involves an aspect of time, right? So there's so much we can say about prayer, but like my own personal experience, like the time with God, the time of prayer, one, I become certain about the goodness of reality in the sense of like there is one who has like conquered death and there is one who like loves me and is making me at this very moment. And usually the way I think most of us start our day is thinking about all the things that we need to do, all the things that we're behind on, the ways that we've let others down, right? Our starting point is our own effort. And in being with the like creator and sustainer of the cosmos and discovering that like he loves you and is calling you to good things and he has like conquered death, it shifts the way like you're in front of your whole life. And then it's also just like good to be with him. And that actually, especially in an efficientistic world, reminds you that, oh yeah, like it is good to be. And we're made to like be with. The other thing is who we're around changes us over time, right? If we're with people long enough, we pick up their phrases, we pick up their mannerisms, we have common jokes, we have inside jokes. You know what I mean? Like there's certain specific things. I could tell, I got to a point in the hallway that I lived in seminary. I knew who was in the hallway by how they walked. Mm-hmm. You know, like the way that they stepped, you're like, you know, that's Jimmy, you know, there's a certain like closeness of a familiarity that happens over time. And Jesus shows us this, like he goes off to be alone with the Father. There are so many things about prayer, that are just so healing and mysterious. And the prayer is like at the heart because of the nature of who God is as Trinity. A communion of love is like the Father loves the Son loves the Father, and like the love between them is the Holy Spirit, a communion of love, right? God is, and God is love, right? That's who he is. And so the nature of our being is this, to be loved and to love and to like be. And we almost relegate everything to doing. And so like I think prayer is more essential than ever. And this is not even talking about praising, like affirming being, interceding for others, right? Serious contemplation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But does that make sense?
Yeah. What would you say to someone who feels like they can't get a connection with God? Like they understand like that prayer is good. It's good to pray to God, but they feel distant from God. And then also, how would you describe prayer during Lent different from our regular prayer? Why is it important to have prayers more full of penance during Lent?
Yeah, I think one, especially when people talk about being disconnected from God and feeling him as distant, I always try to ask some circumstantial questions, right? Sometimes, honestly, there is so much stuff crammed in our brain we actually don't know how to be with. If you've ever had a long day and you're exhausted and someone's talking to you and it's like you can't even hear them, mm-hmm. right? The problem is not the person, right? It's like, man, I need sleep. So sometimes, honestly, like there's a bunch of circumstantial stuff of, is the person getting sleep? Is their brain, like, are they filling their brain with so much stuff through social media or just scrolling or whatever that there's actually no space to hear a word? What's going on at the level of like anxiety, things like that? Those things are a factor. The other part is sometimes it takes time to like learn how to sit and be with him, and we're actually really uncomfortable with that. And so they actually have to learn how to be okay being uncomfortable for a little bit. Which if you think about it, at normal relationships, anytime we meet someone, it's awkward at the beginning, right? Like making friends is awkward at the beginning, mm-hmm. right? But after like enough awkwardness, eventually you become comfortable with each other. What if it's the same dynamic of like, yeah, it's awkward at the beginning, but like we accept the awkwardness. So that's the first thing I would say is like, sometimes honestly with people, like they're doing too much and there's too much in their brain. And so it's not a problem of God distancing himself from them. They're actually just so filled with other stuff that, and he loves our freedom so much that there's just like no space for him. Lent, I would say, like the liturgical season is actually, there's particular graces given during that, right? So we actually can draw closer to God during the time of Lent because it's a special season for that. So prayer can actually be deepened through a particular grace given through Lent. At the level of like penitential, I would say us making more space for him and more space for silence, frankly. I don't think we give nearly enough time for silence. So again, if the experience is the desert, which in the desert, there is like a deprivation of like new stimuli. The desert looks like the desert, right? There's no beautiful trees. There's no water. Like there's very few animals. So there is a sensory deprivation, right? And you learn how to just like be with. And so I think there has to be a ascetical experience of prayer during Lent of I will like endure the awkwardness to be with you. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I also think it's important to, in regards to trying to communicate with God, try to hear God. He's not going to talk to us the way that we want him to, like in a loud voice, physically like speaking to us. Mm. But I think that God talks to us through our daily practices. For example, in order to listen to God talking to you, you have to actively do things that will allow him to talk to you. So, I mean, whether that means reading religious things or fixing your daily schedule in order to not have distractions within it, or doing good things like feeding the homeless or going on mission trips, I think that that's how God can talk to you. Instead of just being busy all day and then at the end of the day praying and asking, why isn't God talking to me? I think it's because you're not performing actions that would allow you to hear him.
It's such a work, you know, like he really does objectively speak to us. And yeah, like you said, it isn't necessarily the booming voice, but I'm living with an Italian priest right now who is learning English. And so communicating is very difficult. And I find that, like we laugh a lot because of like trying to communicate, and I'll like say something very quickly because like my brain's just churning, right? So literally I said, don't worry about this, I'll take care of it, just like that. And he just looked at me and laughed. And I was like, I spoke, because it was like my brain was going quickly, so I spoke way. So we've been like trying to figure out how to communicate. And it's invited a lot of like intentionality of like speaking slower and like listening more and trying to think about things from his perspective. And it's been like a beautiful, for me, meditation on like there really is a like language to communicating with God. Like there is a language for it. The main language is honestly silence, right? But yeah, like the way that he speaks is not according to my criteria. I don't tell Spanish how it's structured, right? I have to receive it and I have to like learn, and I actually have to like change my brain a little bit in order to like get the language system, mm-hmm. right? But then that communication opens you up to a whole world. It's the same thing with God. Just as like frustrating, painful, difficult, whatever, but you can actually communicate with another, it just blossoms into a world, you know? Mm-hmm. Like it's so beautiful. And so I have found over my like, yeah, like there is a like learning to communicate, like learning to receive how he wants to communicate with us.
If you want to communicate better with Father Pierre, I'd recommend using emojis. He's really good at that. It was our running day, and it was raining outside, and he sent me a swimming emoji. So if you could just use emojis more, I think that would work well.
That is a language I will not use.
Okay, the third tenet of Lent is almsgiving. Hmm. And what are other ways of almsgiving other than just giving money?
So, and just to take a step back, when we talk about the three things of Lent of prayer, fasting, almsgiving, they're meant to be restorative in the relationship, right? So the relationship with God, prayer, fasting, oneself, right? Self-mastery, like freedom, growing in freedom, and then almsgiving, the relationship with the other. The reminder that like life as gift and our possessions are given to us so that the world can know Christ, right? So, one, I do think giving to some sort of charitable work and, like, tithing is actually good. And I actually don't think, honestly, like, I don't think college students do it enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, I see how much y'all spend on drinks. You know?
Yeah. You should see us going to Chick-fil-A.
Yeah, well, it's like, yeah, people talk about, like, not having money for it. And then I see how much they spend on things. I'm like, well, you know, maybe we can, like, give some to the Lord. But, like, there is a mentality that's meant to be educated to of, like, you know, when we marry someone, we say, like, everything I have is yours, right? And so part of, like, the saying yes to Christ is, like, everything I have is yours, while still being, like, prudent, right? And, like, being a good steward. But in this, right, there is this recognition of the other as, like, a gift and being responsible for in some way. And so if the, like, those that are in need are part of the body of Christ, then in my saying to Christ, everything I have is yours, that means, like, part of it goes to them, right? So, like, I do know that a lot of college students struggle financially, right? And so it doesn't necessarily need money, mean, like, giving money, but giving of one's time. And it can be as simple as, gosh, so many people eat alone, like, in the dining halls. Like, all right, one day a week, I'm just going to go sit with a random person who's eating alone and talk to them and ask their name and just, like, be with them. I'm going to give in that way. Right? I'm going to give them my full attention for an hour, right? That is an astonishingly beautiful, simple thing. That's almsgiving, right? Or like the homeless person that I see, I'm going to ask their name, I'm going to offer them a granola bar, and I'm going to treat them but with the dignity that they deserve, and I'm going to like be intentional about like doing that, right? In again, a safe, prudent way. But I think having like a space to be educated and reminded of that is so important.
Mm-hmm. A Lenten obligation I see a lot of Christians doing that I really like is trying to tell someone something nice every single day, which it seems simple, but it's really difficult. And when you think about it, you have all these things that you want to tell people about how much you like them. You want to tell your friends how much you love them, but it's very awkward. And I like to think about how happy it would make you feel if someone actually told you nice things about you. It's similar to almsgiving in that you're giving a compliment, but you're also giving up of your own shell. You're giving up your own self to your friends so they can know you more.
No, like I've mentioned it before, this line from Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground, where the underground man says, if I could define man, I would define him as the ungrateful biped, like he who walks on two legs and is ungrateful, mm-hmm. right? And how common that is today, where people don't even see the beautiful things that they're given, right? We don't recognize actually the cost of anything, right? And so one of the things I actually really appreciate about you is like at the end of pretty much every Mass, you like thank me for Mass, right? And it's like, yeah, like I'm doing this because I love it and the Lord has asked me of it. And I'm so grateful for it. But like, I always appreciate like the gesture of gratitude and acknowledging that this is a gift, right? And it's a simple, small thing, but it makes such a difference for people, right? To the where like I remember it, you know? Like the simple things of like seeing something good and affirming it, like we really are like deprived of a people of gratitude. And that doesn't mean that we pretend difficulties don't exist or anything like that. Like that's not what we're talking about. But like the gesture of gratitude, of appreciating things and naming them is so important. One of the things I did one Lent was like, all right, once a week, I'm going to write a letter to someone. Very simple, right? And that was my like almsgiving aspect of it. One, I found it incredibly difficult to, like, make time for it. But as I was doing it, it was really very beautiful. And it was such a, like, good act of love. Because that's something that somebody can hang on to for the rest of their life, you know. And that was a very simple thing, but was very, very meaningful. And me, like, when I get a letter, I always, like, cherish it and really appreciate it, you know. So, like, there's little things with this of actually making space for others, saying yes to them and not just the things of, like, us feeding ourselves through noise that are like that just makes such a difference.
Yeah, the almsgiving lifestyle seems pretty antithetical to the college lifestyle that we have right now. Even in the good things that we do, like good things like studying, our only goal of the day is to serve our grades. If you've only focused on your schoolwork and your grades, You're not giving out yourself to your friends. And I think it's really important, especially during Lent, to be there for your friends and not just for your own grades.
I agree. Like I think that one of the things I worry about with y'all is that college can breed such a selfishness in the sense of you're here for your education, right? So it can almost create a like just thinking about everything according to like myself. And there's no space actually for anybody else, right? And especially Georgia Tech, which is such a difficult school, this can create a like very real thing of creating a mentality of selfishness. And so I think we particularly need these gestures that educate us to, oh, like I belong to a people and like I'm actually called to like love them and make space for them, even while I'm doing the things that's asked of me in my vocation as a student.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to go over quick questions regarding Lenten obligations that I think are important to college students. The first one is how much of an obligation should it be? Like, how serious of an obligation should we take?
I think, one, we have to kind of recognize our own mentality. Some people are, like, very much minimalist or try to game the system. And then other people are like, everything, you know? And it actually can be, like, very choking and not good. So I always, like it, without being, like, relativistic, we have to kind of recognize where we are. Some people will try to be overambitious and they'll end up giving up all of it, or it'll make them like, you know, very legalistic or whatever. Other people, it's like a very bare minimum thing, or like, how do I game the system of like, all right, I'll eat everything right at midnight. And it's like, is this the spirit? You know what I mean? Like, So the bare minimum is fasting and abstinence on Ash Wednesday, no meat on Fridays, and then fasting and abstinence on Good Friday. And the church is inviting us to some sort of action of prayer, fasting, almsgiving. But it's an invitation. It's not something we're actually bound to. But again, it's like we're not meant to have this mentality of, all right, what are the things that I have to do? Because like we don't feel loved when someone's like, all right, what is the bare minimum I have to do for you? Like there's no love in that, right? So it's this like, all right, how do I draw closer to God? That's the question. But I never like the like, what's the bare minimum? Because it reveals a bad mentality. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I think for like the most part, for most people, the first question should be like, what is the Lord actually inviting me to? What are the things that keep me from him? And I would say like one simple practice of prayer, one simple practice of fasting, one simple thing of almsgiving. And not to be like too overambitious, but also not a like minimalist. But very practically what will help you to like draw closer to God. And like if you're stuck on it, ask somebody you trust for advice and who knows you that can like speak into it.
On Lent being a community activity, how should we fast together? What does it mean to fast as a community?
It's a good question. I think that I wish we did more things of like let's like fasting together. Our missionaries actually do a weekly fast for the students, right? They offer something different and they do it together, which I think is really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so I think like you can propose a like, hey, we're going to have some sort of fast together and to do it together as a people. And that can be as simple as, right, yeah, like giving up music for a day, another day of fasting. I will say this because we have some very serious like athletes, or we have people that maybe actually struggle with like really serious like eating disorders and things like that. Like it gets more complicated. And so this is why it's important if you're stuck on things to speak to someone you trust, because there's certain people that are not bound by the Lenten fasts for the sake of health, right? Somebody that's like older is actually not bound by the Lenten fast for the sake of their health, or, you know, somebody that's like really calorically deprived, they're actually not bound by it. So the church is actually super practical. And that's why I think that it's good to, without justifying anything or trying to game the system, if you're unsure, ask someone.
And then how should we carry on these Lenten obligations into the year after Lent? Why are we giving things up before Easter and that we don't have to give them up anymore after Easter?
Because it's a period of abstaining, right? And so it's about like a time of freedom. Like growing in freedom, right? And so, again, it's not that the thing is bad. It's about being in proper relationship to it and also making more space for something else. Again, the example of like eating lunch is good, But if you need to go to the hospital, that takes precedence, right? Mm-hmm. Like taking care of you. But that doesn't mean like, oh, it was a good thing to take you to the hospital. I'm going to do that every day and not eat lunch, mm-hmm. right? It's like, no, there's a time to eat lunch. There's a time to take you to the hospital, right? So that's why, like, in essence, like there is a time of fasting and there is a season of feasting. But our feasting is meant to be celebrating something that has happened, not indulgence. Those are different things. Mm-hmm. And festival is meant to be festival of genuine celebration, but that's different than, okay, like Lent is over, I'm just gonna go ham on ham. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like that's not what this is. It's something beautiful happens, we celebrate.
And so restricting ourselves from these worldly things is a regular or necessary thing. Yeah.
I want to say a quick word about, I'm asking our community to read one thing together over the season of Lent. And the reason why is, like we talked about, like there's the individual practices, but then we belong to a people, right? And so this one thing I'm asking for us to do together is to read these sections of What Saves Us from Nothingness. Beautiful text that's really asking this question, what saves us from nothingness? The nothingness that everyone experiences in some way. I have found it personally like really, really helpful. And I also think it's a great text to give to our friends, even that are non-religious, because it's, I think, for me, one of the best things of articulating this experience that so many people have in a very real way. And so, like, the one thing I'm asking is that, like, as a community, we read this thing together. It's just sections of it. It's not the whole text, but ones that I thought would be, like, most relevant. And so I'd ask, like, those in our community to, like, read this and to discuss it with their friends. The first chapters are a little admittedly difficult, but I think the defining the nothingness is like really helpful in like understanding kind of the existential situation that we're in and like actually what saves us from nothingness. But I would propose in the future, like after people graduate from Georgia Tech, doing one thing with your community during Lent because we're saved as a people. Do you have any questions about it?
Well, is it on nihilism?
In some way, like it's about like, yeah, nihilism or nothingness. But even that, like what we talk about it is the first thing he says is it's suspicion about the ultimate substance of reality and about the positive nature of living. Meaning, if I don't think that reality, that life is ultimately positive or good, in some way that takes away our energy in front of life. And then we tend to distraction. If life is ultimately bad and there's nothing I can do about that, then the best thing that you can do is avoid life, right? Even if you think of this like grind during the week and then party on the weekends. And the party on the weekends is like we obliterate our brains and like we're not present and we're saying reality is bad, right? Mm-hmm. And but what the heart yearns for is for like things to matter and for reality to be good, right? And so this thing of like understanding nothingness as first of all a suspicion about reality, that life is ultimately not good, right? And if I am suspicious about someone, then I don't trust them. And not only that, I'm spending all my energy instead of like doing something with them, wondering, like questioning everything that they say, right? Mm-hmm. And then like there's no possibility of relation, like deep intimacy if there's suspicion, right? So I think it's very relevant today. So many people have questions about like, what is my life? Or like, is life good? And so I think he gets at, Father Julian Caron is really giving a language and a really important way to what so many people experience. And then like what actually responds to that. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's so important.
Something I love about the Catholic faith is the belief that existence itself is a good thing. And I find it's very hard for other philosophies to justify this. And a lot of philosophies will just completely disagree. A lot of Eastern religions see life as suffering. I think of the philosopher Albert Camus, who wrote about the myth of Sisyphus, mm-hmm. who believed that existence itself is suffering, and the only way to get happiness is to create your own artificial happiness in order to distract yourself. And I see it a lot in other philosophies. For example, I find it difficult for utilitarians to justify that existence is good, because a lot of them see existence as only creating problems and creating pains.
which is fascinating because they're using existence to argue that, which implies, you know, like mm-hmm. there's actually a lot of like contradictions deep down that people don't really look at with it, you mm-hmm. know, like there's the, I think it's Gorgias, G-O-R-G-I-A-S in Dante's Inferno. He's in the realm of like the blasphemers. And so he's just lying down, cussing out God, right? Blaspheming. And there is an inherent contradiction in what he's doing because he's using being to say being is bad, mm-hmm. which you need being in order to do the act of saying being is bad, meaning it implies that it's good. Mm-hmm. So whenever we use our being to go against being, there is a contradictory implication that being is good because I'm using being to go against being. And so it is like contradictory from its very nature in the act of acting it out, which I find like very fascinating, right? That's kind of an aside. But like, yeah, I think that like there's something so healing about what we live that, yeah, we believe that reality is good, like is actually a gift and is beautiful while also being in front of the mysteries of suffering, especially the suffering of the innocent, like the mystery of sickness, death, sin, all of these things.
Yeah, I think a lot in our modern society, and especially for college students, we could see life as just struggles and pains. And is this this text, what saves us from nothingness, is this about finding the good that is within all this struggle?
You'll have to read it.
Okay.
I love. There's a section in here that I think is one of the most helpful, beautiful things I think I've ever read. But I don't want to like. I think we have to do the work, and so I would propose like reading it. I think you'll know the section when you read it. But there's a journey that has to be made. Just like we don't jump to Easter, like at the level of method, we have to make the journey. So that's why we have Lent. That's why like I want us to like read this text together.
Thank you for listening. This has been the Torchlight Catholic Podcast with Father Branson and Jude McIntyre. Remember to pray for each other during Lent, and I hope you have a successful Lent that brings you closer to God.
God bless.